Air America Radio and the Interfaith Alliance Foundation present State of Belief, Religion and Radio Done Differently. Here's your host, the Reverend Welton Gaddy.
Welcome, everyone, to State of Belief for the first weekend in the AR era. That's the after Rove era, and you can spell it E-R-A or E-R-R-O-R. I'm Welton Gaddy, president of the Interfaith Alliance, broadcasting this week from the Air America studios in New York City. Today, when you think of summer camp, you probably think of sing-alongs, toasted marshmallows, kayaking. But do you think of this?
The lack of conversation between students of different faiths at my school seems to be a metaphor for the rest of the world.
We'll hear from several young people who participated in the Interfaith Alliance's summer camp, focusing on the First Amendment and religious liberty. But don't think this is the only camp in town, and it might shock you when you hear the unbelievable agenda at the new youth camp set up by the John Birch Society. Also on today's show, we'll take a special look at a new movie about combating hate crimes with a producer who is one of our own. But first, what happens when the fight to keep religion out of politics turns personal? Last week, we talked about the ongoing discussion regarding religious leaders endorsing political candidates. Episcopal Bishop Gene Robinson's endorsement of Senator Barack Obama for president touched off passionate reactions from people on both sides of the debate. I made my feelings very clear about the risks that are involved with such an endorsement and why I'm sorry that the integrity of religious leaders can be damaged for political purposes. Following the events of this past week, I'm not too sure that maintaining integrity was on the mind of Pastor Wiley Drake. At the beginning of the week, Pastor Drake released an endorsement of Republican presidential candidate Mike Huckabee. The press release was issued on official church letterhead from the Southern Baptist Church of Buena Park, California. Drake went on to repeat the endorsement on his church-affiliated radio show featuring an official campaign commercial. Much as the Interfaith Alliance spoke out against the Barack Obama campaign's political use of Bishop Gene Robinson's Obama endorsement, Americans United for Separation of Church and State took issue with Drake's endorsement of Huckabee, and they filed an official complaint with the IRS asking for an investigation into potential violation of election law by the Southern Baptist Church of Buena Park. But the story doesn't end there. Several days later, Wiley Drake went back on the radio to deliver yet another announcement. This time, it was not an endorsement. Instead, he asked his followers to pray for the demise of Americans United and its staff members. Specifically, he singled out two staff members from the Americans United Communications Office whose names appeared on the press release. They wanted bad things to happen to these guys. We know how important it is to police the intersection of religion and politics. But as these staff members of Americans United now know, it can quickly become personal, even frightening. I have often said, there is no mean in the world like those being mean for Jesus. So how is Americans United dealing with the attack from Wiley Drake? Joining us now is my friend, the Executive Director of Americans United for Separation of Church and State, Reverend Barry Lynn. Barry, welcome back to State of Belief.
It's nice to be back, and I am still here in spite of the attacks of Pastor Wiley Drake.
Well, what was the reaction within Americans United on hearing Wiley Drake's call for prayer against you and your staffers?
I think the general reaction was one of a surprise, because we have never, in the many instances in which we've reported unlawful conduct or what we consider to be unlawful conduct involving the tax laws, no one has ever responded in this fashion. Usually they try to say, well, we didn't really do it, or we did it, but we didn't really think it's anything wrong with it, or we're going to sue the IRS. A lot of reactions, but never, we are going to start imprecatory prayers against the staff, specific members. He sent out a press release indicating some of the examples of prayers that should be used, including to make the spouses widows and the children orphans of the staff members that he has targeted. So it's a belligerency that most people, frankly, have not seen here.
Now, Barry, if I correctly understand imprecatory prayer, it comes usually from the psalmist, and it's a prayer of complaint to God, or of a request for God to take vengeance on someone for the sake of righteousness. I have a strong sense that this isn't about righteousness. It's about political partisanship.
I think Pastor Drake, although he can characterize it as he has, as an assault on God, he said not just an assault on his endorsement, he can call it what he wants. But I think that Pastor Drake understands that this is designed as an example of why a group like Americans United for Separation of Church and State is anti-God, because we would dare to criticize anything that he, a pastor of the faith, has done. I mean, it's an extraordinary stretch to act as if God would be concerned about the IRS code and its application or non-application to Pastor Drake out in California.
Did this upset your communication staff to see their names used as specific targets?
You know, it actually, whether one is a believer or a non-believer, somewhere in between, when people decide to send out a press release naming specific members of a staff of an organization and wish for these dire consequences, disability, death, of course it disturbs people. It shocks them. It disturbs them because one never knows, as many bloggers have pointed out, when is someone going to say, well, if we should pray for them to be hurt, maybe we ought to, as individuals, go out and just hurt them ourselves. There are a lot of people with very strange priorities, very strange ideas of what is right and wrong. And all of us, you included, hear from these people on a regular basis. This just escalates the concern that some folks in the blogosphere had about the personal safety of people in our line of work.
Barry, let's turn for a moment from the vengeance to the source of cause of all of this. On the scale of mild to very serious, how bad a violation of election law do you think has been perpetrated here, and what could the consequences be?
Well, I would put this up in the 7 or 8 category out of 10. It's a very serious and seemingly very deliberate effort. By using church stationery from the particular Southern Baptist church that Pastor Drake runs in Buena Vista, California, to claiming that he is, on the one hand, he says, speaking as an individual, but using the resources of the church, using the church as the basis for his radio program every day, using church stationery, and also claiming that he is the second vice president of the Southern Baptist Convention, of which there is some dispute. Nevertheless, he seemed to be gathering all of the support, resources, background, and potency of his position with the Southern Baptist Convention to proclaim his views about politics, specifically the former governor of Arkansas, Mike Huckabee, be the next president of the United States, because he was more qualified, as he put it, than the other guys.
Do you think he understands what a serious violation this is and is just trying to distract from the issue by calling for these attack prayers? What's going on?
I've met Pastor Drake a number of times in person and on television shows, and I don't think he frankly cares what the civil law is. He believes he is the only one of the few people who understands what God wants, including apparently who he wants to be the next president, and he's going to say it regardless of consequences. He indicated in a press release just a few days ago that indeed if the IRS came to visit him about this, he would introduce them to Jesus, which is another way to just simply ignore the severity of the allegations of misconduct.
You know, Barry, I'm thinking about the candidates themselves. I know they can't be responsible for everybody that's a supporter, but I wonder if you would join me in asking Governor Huckabee to denounce this kind of campaign tactic among his advocates.
You know, I do wish that Governor Huckabee would specifically, unequivocally condemn this kind of tactic. And frankly, I wish he would condemn the politicking from the church resources that was the genesis of this, and then also, or at a minimum, explain that this is not a tactic that is appropriate in an American democratic system. To my knowledge, no one has yet asked him to do that.
Barry Lynn is the Executive Director of Americans United for Separation of Church and State. Barry, thanks for helping us understand what happened. We'll continue to follow this case. And thanks, as always, for being with us on State of Belief.
It's always a pleasure. Thank you.
Still to come, summer camp, Interfaith Alliance style. And up next, you'll find out why we're giving a thumbs up to one of the Republican presidential candidates for his handling of religion on the campaign trail. I'm Welton Gaddy, and you're listening to State of Belief on Air America Radio. Welcome back to State of Belief. I'm Welton Gaddy. And to be sure, it takes a lot of people to operate the traffic lights at the intersection of religion and politics. For us here at State of Belief, there are plenty of people fighting the good fight. None of them more tirelessly than William Blake, the Media Relations Associate for the Interfaith Alliance. William is just about the first person we hear from every morning, whether we want to or not. Before the sun is completely risen, he's already scoured hundreds of news sources in order to let us know what should be on our radar on any given day. And right now, William joins us to take part in our Intersection Award presentation for this week. Hello, William.
Hey, Welton. Thanks for having me on the show. It's great to be here.
What red lights and green lights are you handing out at the intersection of religion and politics this week?
Well, even though we're about 440 days away from the 2008 election, the presidential candidates are campaigning as if it were just a few hours away. And I've got a couple of intersection awards that I wanted to hand out for incidents that have happened on the campaign trail. I'm afraid we need to start with a red light to a group called the U.S. Christians for Truth, for attacking the Mormon faith of former Massachusetts Governor Mitt Romney at the Iowa straw poll in Ames, Iowa, over the weekend. A retired pastor in Iowa attended the straw poll last weekend, handing out literature that read, "We strongly believe that Jesus Christ, if he were alive today in flesh in this time and voted, would never vote for Mitt Romney under any circumstances." Now, I should also mention that the pastor isn't just angry at Romney. His flyer on the other side of it advises Christian voters to stay away from Rudy Giuliani, Newt Gingrich, John McCain, and Fred Thompson because, quote, "they can never make a strong case for families or for strong Christian values." Now, that's a heck of a name for an interest group, Welton, isn't it? U.S. Christians for Truth. Now, Welton, you're an American and a Christian, and I suspect you support the truth. Would you consider yourself a member?
Oh, thanks, William. I'm glad your job is secure. You know, this thing, truth, is not only something that Christians are compelled to pursue. Some Christians think they are compelled to define it. And once you've made a definition of truth, then there's no room for elections. There's no room for discussion. There's only room for agreement or denouncement. And it sounds like that this group, through some kind of psychiatric and spiritual chicanery, has convinced itself that it's the guardian of truth, and anyone that doesn't see truth as they see it doesn't have a place in the American political system. Frankly, it's a sad definition of religion, and it's a gross misunderstanding of politics.
Well, that actually leads into a nice segue, because the second story that I have today is a green light, and it's a much more positive example of candidates talking about religion on the campaign trail. A green light, I think, should go to former New York City Mayor Rudy Giuliani. At a town hall meeting in Iowa last week, a voter asked Giuliani whether he considered himself, quote, a traditional practicing Catholic, to which Giuliani responded, quote, my religious affiliation, my religious practices, and the degree to which I am a good or not so good Catholic, I prefer to leave to the priests. That's a personal discussion, and they have a much better sense of how good a Catholic I am or how bad a Catholic I am. Giuliani also added, I don't think there should be a religious test for public office.
I think it's very interesting that people can hold the right view for possibly the wrong reasons. Giuliani is comfortable holding that view because his campaign, I think, has decided there's no need in appealing to the evangelical Christian community. So it's simply a non-factor, and he can easily make the statement he did and dismiss it. Mitt Romney, on the other hand, is in a different situation. He does not want to be judged on the basis of his devotion to the Mormon Church, and that is precisely the way it should be. But Romney can't have it both ways. He can't say, on the one hand, I don't want you judging me on the basis of my faith. That's true. But he can't say that and then turn around and in the same campaign speech claim that people ought to be for him because of his embodiment and representation of great Christian values. I think we're in the best shape if we stay with the Constitution and say there is no religious test for public office, whether you're Giuliani or whether you're Mitt Romney or whether you're running for any office in this nation. William, stay right there because I have my own Intersection Award nominee this week. All of you, stay with us. I'm Reverend Welton Gaddy, and this is State of Belief on Air America Radio. This is State of Belief on Air America Radio. I'm Reverend Welton Gaddy, and William Blake, Media Relations Associate for the Interfaith Alliance, is still with us to take part in our Intersection Award presentation for this week. I have my own Intersection Award nominee this week, but I don't think I'm going to present this recipient with a red, green, or even a yellow light, and I'll tell you why. The recipient is the Youth Meets Truth Summer Camps. The camps are organized throughout the nation by an organization affiliated with the ultra-conservative John Birch Society. A trip to their website, youthmeetstruth.org, paints a conflicting portrait, frankly. On one hand, there are photos of young people in the outdoors participating in all kinds of summer activities. But on the other, there's the description of the camp's agenda. It includes teaching campers that, quote, we are one nation under God, and our nation is great because it was founded on Judeo-Christian principles. It tells campers, in the true spirit of the John Birch Society, to watch out. It cryptically warns them against a group called the Insiders, which apparently wants to oppress Americans through the use of government. And it encouraged the campuses to take action and share the information they learned at camp with their friends and relatives. So, instead of a traffic light, here's what I'm proposing for the Youth Meets Truth summer campers. I'm hoping that when they follow this instruction to share these indoctrinated views with their peers, those peers happen to be teenagers who attended the recent camp sponsored by the Interfaith Alliance, the LEAD camp, which stands for Leadership, Education, Advancing Democracy and Diversity. That camp shares a much different philosophy than what is proposed by the John Birch Society camp. Whereas those campers can see right on the Youth Meets Truth website that there is a right way and a wrong way to look at the world, LEAD campers are encouraged to explore history, to look at current events, to examine themselves in order to find the truths that they hold to be self-evident. It often manifests itself in conversations among campers, conversations like this one.
I came here because I really felt that I needed to know how to conduct an interfaith discussion and talk about my beliefs and hear the other person's beliefs, but I wanted to be able to do it in a respectful way. And I felt that I needed LEAD to sort of give me a base for that before I could go out into the world and start talking with people and actually doing good things for the community.
One night last week, I got to spend some time with this year's campers, and I have to say it was one of the sharpest group of young people that I've ever been around. I left time for them to raise questions, and frankly, though I do a lot of interviews on media, these kids asked me some of the most intense and difficult questions that I've been asked recently. William also was there and was able to spend some time with the LEAD campers. William, what were your main impressions of this group?
Wow. Well, the campers that I got to spend some time with are just so incredibly bright and passionate. I think we were very lucky to find so many young people who were interested in the issues of pluralism and religious liberty. It buoyed my spirits just being around them and interacting with them for a few days.
Well, let's listen for ourselves. I want us to listen to some of the conversations that you had with these campers and what their thoughts and ideas revealed to us about the future of interfaith leadership in this country.
My name is Aaron Match, and I come from Harrisburg, Pennsylvania, and I am Jewish.
I'm Ben Lukens. I come from East Rockaway on Long Island, New York, and I am a UCC Protestant.
I'm Ryan Nakasone. I'm from Hawaii, and I'm Buddhist.
Malik Jamal McKinnon. My hometown is Raleigh, North Carolina, and my religious background is Christianity.
My name is Tanya Bracci. I am from Tampa Bay, Florida. And I am a Shia Ismaili Muslim.
My name is Kendra Stewart. I'm from Raleigh, North Carolina. I'm a Christian and a member of the AME Zion Church.
My name is Ben Chadwell. I come from Camp Hill, Pennsylvania. I am Jewish. Probably the most important thing we learned was how to get our message of not only tolerance, which is putting up with other faiths, but pluralism, which is reaching out to other faiths and trying to understand them.
I had never been in an environment where religion didn't matter too much, and there's all these different ethnicities around me, and it was just this easy atmosphere to be in where we could just ask, oh, what faith are you? And they would just respond without feeling uncomfortable.
North Carolina is, at least where I am from, in North Carolina, there isn't that much diversity. I know a few people from other religions, but it's not much. I don't get to really experience them. If there are other religions that maybe we aren't aware of that actually are there, but they just don't get a chance to really show themselves, maybe we can give them a chance to come out and share their beliefs.
My plan itself is I want to start basically a political action group back at my school, as well as connecting the youth of my church with the different churches around my community. I feel like there's a lot of ignorance and apathy, and I figure the faster we get rid of that, the faster more people will take charge.
My goal is to create a jazz band, an interfaith jazz band, so because music is one of the things that brings people together. We would have different instruments from different cultures, and we would all be together, and the first step would be to get the word out there that something new is coming.
One of the things we're based upon in our democracy are the Constitution and the Declaration of Independence, and that's how we became what we are today. And to see those documents in real life, the actual documents, that was probably the most emotional part of that experience. And I actually just took the time to stare at the actual Constitution, and I just read the preamble. Being able to stand there in front of such a protected document that's fading, but the preamble is just there, dark and bold, and I just took the time to read it and really think about it. It was really touching, and that was probably my most emotional experience.
I think what's interesting about going to any camp is that when you first go there, you kind of wear a little facade of how you want to act in front of other people and the first impression you want to make, and then within 2 days you just have that broken down by all your new friends that you made, and you can come out and be who you really are. And I think that's what making friends really does too, making such close bonding experiences with people. It's really the little things that really do it, you know, laughing together, talking together, singing and just being silly, but then at the same time sharing intellectual experiences and discussing and arguing and debating, and it all just factors together in a really every complex relationship that you have.
William, as you think back to those interviews with the campers, what was the one thing that was said or done that really stuck with you?
I think it was the bond that the campers had formed with each other. Some of the campers had known some of their colleagues before they went to lead. But the kids mostly met each other for the first time, and by the end of the week, I had so many campers telling me they felt like they knew their peers for their entire lives and that these were incredible friendships that they had formed. It left a really lasting impression on me. 14 different religious traditions were represented, kids from, you know, several states all over the country. I mean, we had kids from the South to the West Coast, to the Northeast, to the Midwest. You know, some of them didn't look like their peers. They didn't talk like their peers. And yet they found common ground because they were all young people who had passion and interest in religious liberty and religious pluralism. That's just so incredibly commendable.
William, thanks for sharing this with us, and thanks for all of your help this week on State of Belief. Up next, we take a look at Faith on Film, and a film that took a leap of faith by one of our Interfaith Alliance staff members to get it made. We'll tell you about it in just a moment. I'm Welton Gaddy. This is State of Belief on Air America Radio.
State of Belief journeys behind the camera lens to get a look at Faith on Film.
I'm especially proud to bring you this week's Faith on Film segment because the producer of the film happens to be a staff member of the Interfaith Alliance. A Dream in Doubt tells the story of a Sikh American whose life was forever altered by the 9/11 terrorist attacks. No one he knew was killed on the day of the attacks, but his brother became the first post-9/11 hate crime murder victim in America. The film is directed by Tammy Yeager and was produced by our own Preet Mahan Singh, who is the Deputy Director of Public Policy at the Interfaith Alliance. A Dream in Doubt is playing this Tuesday, August 21st, at the IFC Theater in New York City. And Preet Singh joins us now to talk about it. Preet, thanks for joining us on State of Belief.
Thanks for having me, Welton.
I know there's a story behind this movie and how it came to be. I think our listeners would like to hear that, if you'll share it with us.
Sure, Welton. For Rana Sodhi's family, these brothers came to America to escape for religious freedom. And 4 days after 9/11, one of their brothers is murdered in this senseless act of violence when someone pulls up to a gas station, shoots, and says, "I'm an American," when he's arrested. And to think that somebody sees a turban and a beard and automatically equates it with terrorism would be like after Timothy McVeigh bombed Oklahoma City, if people went around and said, "Well, you're white and you've got, you know, certain features, and we're going to attack you now." I mean, just how preposterous that is. That's really the story behind it. But what we see from Rana's family is the sense that America's better than that, and that the American dream is stronger than that. So there is this hatefulness, but there's also this resilience that really comes through in the film. And we've also, because it's kind of a heavy story, we've included some humorous moments throughout the film, which really shed light on what it really truly means to be someone who is Sikh and American at the same time, which I think many communities can relate to.
Preet, how did you first hear about Rana Sodhi's story?
Well, I actually got a call from my father the morning of 9/11. He's an early riser, and this was at 6 in the morning in California, where I was living at the time. And he called me and he said, "You know, you shouldn't go to work today. You know, if you haven't turned on the TV yet," which I hadn't, he said, "you know, there have been these attacks." And he called me again 4 days later because he had heard from some family and friends at the Sikh Gurdwara, our house of worship, that someone had been shot. So my dad was glued to all of this. I was just in a state of shock, and I actually was going back and forth to work starting the very next day. But I heard about it from my father, who draped his Honda Accord with American flags, because wearing a turban and a beard, he knew that something like this could happen. And when I heard, I was shocked, but I can't say I was totally surprised.
Preet, when did you decide this film had to be made?
Well, for both me and Tammy, who knew each other before 9/11, we had heard about hate crimes happening around the country, but there had been nothing about Balbir Singh Sodhi 4 days after 9/11 in the national media, largely because it just was a blip, because there were so many uncertainties. We just had this calamity in America. And so we watched as this phenomenon of hate crimes against Arab Americans, Muslims, South Asians, Sikhs continued. And we wondered, why wasn't America talking about this hate? And Tammy, who is not Sikh, and myself, who became very involved with the Sikh community, I was the director of the Sikh American Legal Defense and Education Fund here in Washington. We decided that we needed to make this film, and we needed to make it because the 9/11 story wasn't just complete about the terrorism. We also needed to talk about the double attacks that many Americans faced, first from the terrorists, but then from our own neighbors and coworkers.
What does your work at the Interfaith Alliance have to do, if anything, with your work on this project, or is there any overlap?
There's a tremendous amount of overlap. We have a campaign right now called Legislate Against Hate by 08, and this campaign is all about preventing future Balbir Singh Sodhis. God forbid another terrorist attack in America. I don't want another family to lose a brother or a son or a daughter to a senseless act of violence. And so, you know, we've had stories of James Byrd, Vincent Chin, Matthew Shepard that have been immortalized through films. And now I see the Interfaith Alliance really being a conduit with all of our local alliances around the country, doing screenings, getting other folks who don't know about the Interfaith Alliance involved. I mean, I consider going to a film a pretty light lift. Going to a meeting can be a heavy lift, but coming to watch a film about a core issue that the Interfaith Alliance has been working on for over a decade, to say that we need the most comprehensive hate crimes legislation so that all people are covered and all incidents are covered, is a direct fit with A Dream in Doubt.
The Interfaith Alliance staff showed A Dream in Doubt to the lead campers, in fact, the night that I was with them. And when the film ended, there was a stark, substantive silence that preceded then applause. You've seen this film a lot of times. You've put a lot of your energy and effort into seeing that it came to fruition. When you see this film, what do you, Preet Mahan Singh, feel?
You know, I think about my mother, who persuaded my father to come to America, and we went from being a relatively well-off family in India to moving to the U.S., and she made those sacrifices so that we could achieve the American dream. And I remember sitting with the leaders, and this always comes back because my mom died about 6 years ago. And I always think, you know, here's someone making a sacrifice to come to America, much like the Sodhi family did. And I just want all of the viewers to know that there are Americans who are as quintessentially American as the generations that came before us. And if they don't fit a stereotype, it doesn't mean that they're any less American than you or me or anybody else. So I hope the film builds those bridges.
A Dream in Doubt is showing this Tuesday night, August 21st, at the IFC Theater in New York. Preet and Tammy Yeager both will be on hand for a question and answer session following the film. Go to stateofbelief.com for more information. Preet, congratulations on your work. Thank you for being a part of our organization, and we'll see you at the IFC Theater on Tuesday.
Thank you, Welton.
Well, that's our show for this week. Thanks, as always, for spending the time with us. If you have thoughts about this week's show or anything at all, really, let us know by going to stateofbelief.com, where you can send us an email. Or you can call us at 212-871-8280. That's 212-871-8280. State of Belief is produced by the Interfaith Alliance Foundation, a not-for-profit organization, which is also responsible for such year-round initiatives as the LEAD Summer Camp and the One Nation Many Faiths Election Year Program. And much of this is made possible by listeners like you who become members of the Interfaith Alliance. Go to interfaithalliance.org to learn more. Next week, we'll be joined by one of the few American soldiers to be granted conscientious objector status during the Iraq War. Until then, you all take care of each other. I'm Reverend Welton Gaddy, and that's State of Belief.
State of Belief, religion and radio done differently.